I'm 11, the 29th of April 1964 to the 28th of April 1965. Over. Glenn Gould versus J.S. Bach by Olo J. Milkman. On my birthday in 1964, the top single on the charts was Peter and Gordon's A World Without Love. I didn't want to take that as a harbinger for the year to come, so when it came on the radio during the first week of my 11th year, I made sure to turn it right off in a ritual act of intuitive magic, the kind children believe in, though not letting on what I was up to around my father, who would not have seen my actions as valid as some of his own rituals within the church, though I did. That was also the year my father, and by extension the rest of his family, including me, was sent on a missionary exchange to Canada by his church. He was to start on the western coast and sermonise his way across the continent to the eastern provinces, charming the offspring of colonialists with his accent from the homelands and spreading the word of his God. I was having none of that side of it, but was certainly looking forward to the journey. Canada, to an 11-year-old, was the land of cowboys, lumberjacks, wild animals, and remote expanses of nothing, considering the lingering grey and carbonised air of the United Kingdom's industrial age and its leftover stonework. Canada sounded like a good way to spend a year. We docked at Halifax, Nova Scotia, only long enough to collect our bags, walk to the railway station and catch a train to somewhere in the prairies. And there we changed trains to one that took us through the Rockies until their sudden end made way for water at the edge of the continental landmass. Vancouver was a port city, built on selling lumber, with a Chinese population brought in to do most of the building. My father was to be a guest preacher at the Fountain Chapel, Vancouver's first black church. On our first visit to the church, we met Nora, the co-founder and choir mistress, lovely woman. I remember fondly of her offering unfamiliar pastries and also introducing me to the textures of sweetened, glutinous rice that came from the large and somewhat segregated Chinese community nearby. She also looked a bit like Jimi Hendrix, but had a better voice. My father's sermons went over well, and soon enough, we were on a train snaking through the Rocky Mountains again, on our way to the prairie provinces, rolling out the other side of the wall of mountains I had previously seen heading west. The prairie provinces were monotonous expanses of planted grains, briefly dotted by settlements of Ukrainian, Polish, German, and other colonial descendants. Sometimes we'd see a member of the Cree or the Blackfoot Nations, Indians, as we still called them back then, a term I never understood because it must have been quickly obvious to the early colonialists that they had in fact not found India, and these certainly were not Indian people. But I suppose people were linguistically lazy and just stuck with it. Nonetheless, it was obvious the land's original inhabitants were not being treated well. And in those small prairie towns, my father often took what little extra we might have had for that day and passed it to them in a missionary journey of charity. He never raised the subject of what the church was actually doing to those first Canadians back then and for hundreds of years prior. But I suspect he may have been teaching me willful ignorance during that time. By the time we reached Quebec, the country was in full-blown panic over the design of its flag, trying to get it right before the Queen arrived to celebrate 100 years of dominion. I was not disappointed to have missed the Beatles playing a few months prior to her arrival. At age 11, I already knew they were shite, though that would change with the release of Strawberry Fields Forever in a few short years. My father, however, was more upset to have made it to Montreal only to hear that Glenn Gould had stopped performing live concerts. At the age of 11, I was also too young to appreciate Mr. Gould's prescience. For a few months, we were based in Montreal's Scots community, but on a few occasions, my father was sent to Quebec City to offer guest sermons to rooms full of disinterested French speakers. One of these trips coincided with a visit from Queen Elizabeth and Philip. A riot broke out when French anti-monarchists took issue with the Queen's presence. And for a brief moment, I stood in the streets feeling a real sense of upheaval in the air, a sense that this was the energy of change. This is what happened when people got mad enough. My father got us off the streets, and shortly after, we returned to Montreal. The remainder of the trip snaked its way through the more populously dense eastern coastline. There was a noticeable decrease in the First Nation presence the further east we went, and the percentage of black people rose as we arrived back in Halifax. Later learning of its place in the slave trade, I began to feel like the whole continent was built on the misery of displacing people who were already there, only to replace them with people who didn't really want to be there. My dreams of cowboys, lumberjacks, and adventure thoroughly dissolved. A few months later, we returned to Scotland by ship, arriving back in the UK just before my next birthday, when the number one single was The Beatles' Ticket to Ride, which somehow I felt appropriate, though I could not put my finger on why.
Under. Pop Had Already Eaten Itself by Hugh Reynolds. Ripping open an embossed envelope in hope of a pound note, all I found was a dingy card with some copperplate script inside, wishing you a splendid 11th year. This was odd and uncomfortable. It was my 11th birthday, so I'd already lived through my 11th year. Did this bode ill or well? If music was anything to go by, and it was, at least on Sunday nights after enough wax had been cleared from my too-oft-thick ears and shipped to Madame Tussauds, reliving that 11th year would have been fab. The universe seemed to have different plans, though. It shifted me on through time in a linear fashion, probably just to spite my befuddled granny. Two tracks pulled on my attention through 1964. Not the ones running out of Corby, keeping me taut between the southerly temptations of Kettering and the northerly delights of Uppingham. No, these were musical tracks. Here's the first. I was round at my deaf pal Dusky Bolitus' house. These days we'd skirt around the issue of Dusky's deafness and just call him a pal. In stories like this, when I ask him to pass me my Vimto from the mantelpiece and he just carries on watching telly, you might start wondering about it, but you wouldn't call it out. I had lots of friends, but only one deaf one, Dusky. Only one with a TV, Dusky again. Dusky was desperate to find a way to see The Mask of the Red Death, having fallen into a premature obsession with one of its stars, the young Jane Asher. We'd already spent the previous 3 nights freezing our proverbials off outside the Odeon, failing to bribe an irresponsible adult to act as guardian and get us through the gate. Dusky thought it would be fourth time lucky, but I wanted to stay in and watch Vision on. I always went round to Dusky's to watch Vision on. The show was designed specifically for those with hearing impairment, so, of course, Dusky hated it. His mother insisted he watch. Usually he'd let me come over on condition that I brought him a shoplifted copy of 16 magazine, replete with features such as, "What is Jane Asher really like?" Yet this one night, even a centrefold spread of the red-haired It Girl and future Sugarcraft guru couldn't sate Dusky's lust. We were there in the sitting room, me yearning to see if my latest Piero Manzoni-inspired art effort would make it into the Vision on gallery. Dusky, with his pressing pang for McCartney's muse. A brawl ensued as I tried to stop Dusky turning off the TV set in protest. It was when he had two fingers up my nostrils that I bit down on a stray finger of his free hand. His elbow jerked into the glass of Vimto, which smashed on impact with the hearth tiles and seeped deep not only into Mrs. Bollett's creamy shag pile, but atop it, the latest edition of 16 magazine. Stumbling over the broken glass, Dusky, a hefty chap, yes, yes, in those days we called him fat, rolled onto me, lodging several stray shards deep into my arse. And a few minutes later, I had got my way. Pants down, prone on Dusky's settee with Mrs. Bollettus, tweezing out the offending glass pieces. It's not the piercing pain nor the satisfaction that stays with me. It's that music, the Netherlandish novel tones rendition of Left Bank 2, overlaid on a visual of the very special can of artist's feces I'd forwarded to the BBC. Dusky sat on a stool, in a silent sulk, gazing forlornly at a now semi-transparent image, one he'd managed to rescue from the soggy periodical, Asher, miniskirted and overlay maroon. As it happened, and as I've more recently come to realise by means too indirect to go into here, there was a tenuous family tie between the cause of the glass bottom incident and the second tune that stalked me throughout that year. I took it to be a thought experiment in verse, a cantata cum conundrum. Can birds ever sing out of tune? Jane Asher's brother Peter sang, in a saccharine harmony with Gordon Waller, that they could. I held out that this was a preposterous suggestion given the absence of schooling in any kind of harmonic system by which avian songsmiths might measure their failings. Each morning, so as to better contemplate such matters and delay the progress to school, I would secrete myself in our coal hole. My hamster, Loneliness, would come too. We had a tumultuous relationship, my Loneliness and I. In some regards, it mirrored the one between Jane Asher and her beetle. If you skip ahead a few years, you might read about the afternoon Loneliness woke early from her newspaper nest, nuzzled up to the cage bars, only to spy me fondling a ferret without her blessing. Thankfully, no amount of gnawing would facilitate her escape to denounce me and my honour on live TV. In the dark depths of that cellar, soothing my school tie and letting Loneliness creep up my blazer sleeve, it was much easier to conceive of a world without love. I guess I did all this as an escape from ground-level miseries, just like the lie I'd tell myself and still tell others from time to time that I was a popular boy and that I had loads of pals. I couldn't face the fact that Dusky, a distant cousin my mam matched me up with against both our wills, was the closest I had to a mate since our move to Little Scotland. That Peter and Gordon song was penned by McCartney. Such was the incestuous merry-go-round of who you know not what. It was wrong on other levels too. If you're desperate for love, a world without it is an easier place to abide. You're not seeing those with plenty all around you strutting out and flaunting it. What a song, though. A youth culture so suffused with Beatlemania, whether phony or not, ends up becoming its own metric. Before I turned 12, pop had already eaten itself. I'd moved to Corby, Northamptonshire, but I may as well have moved to Corby, the small crater on Mars, just over 4 miles in diameter. It's a pretty mean and mealy-mouthed thing that the International Astronomical Union, having named the crater Corby in 1979, insist that they don't intend it as any sort of commemoration of the earthly place, merely a randomly picked label. There's your world without love. And loneliness died before I reached the age of 12.
A Troubled Dream. The Osmonds on a Plane by John D. Pearson. Okay, I am about 4, but not 4. I'm every year old. I am in bed, and I hear a plane flying over the house, so I jump out of bed to watch the plane as it flies over, because I was told by my mum that the Osmonds are the passengers on the plane. So, I get out, pull the curtains back, and wave at the Osmonds. Every fucking night.